Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Imagine being in a business that loses 55% of its business in 1 year and nearly that much in the previous year. Such is the state of the North American beekeeper. And so we ask, is there a strategy to save the honeybee and its keepers? Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,410th edition of the Food Chain. And perhaps you're among our friends over there in Dijon who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, they say that the Apis mellifera, the Western honeybee, it's responsible for one out of every three bites of food we eat. However, according to the annual U.S. Beekeeping Survey published by Auburn University, 55.6% of managed honeybee colonies in the country were lost between April 24 and April 25, the years there, that is. Also, according to that survey, U.S. beekeepers experienced record high losses for the 2024-2025 season, for the second year in a row, and that this loss is the highest on record. The obstacles honeybees and their keepers must overcome to survive provide us with those 1 in 3 bites of food include harsh winters, varroa mites, bacteria and virus pathogens, poor nutrition, extensive travel, toxic chemicals, and competition from unscrupulous merchants of adulterated or fraudulent honey. Given all that must be overcome to get those 1 in 3 bites of food, we ask, is there a strategy to save the honeybee and its keepers? Well, here to help us find an answer, we have Matt Malika, who is Senior Project Director at the Keystone Policy Institute, high up on the hill above Denver. Mm-hmm. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you, Michael, for having me.
Yes. Are you a Montana boy?
I am a Massachusetts boy who moved to Montana right out of high school and lived in Missoula for several years.
Still have that forever. Okay.
Yep.
Well, I'm a Montana boy too, only I'm living in California now.
Where were you in Montana?
I was a Billings boy.
Okay.
Out there in cow country.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, let's see. Do we have a strategy to save the honeybee and its keepers?
We do.
We do.
Yes. Recently published.
Good.
So I work for the Keystone Policy Center. And so it's a nonprofit that just celebrated its 50th anniversary in existence, formed in 1975. And so I'm a mediator. I bring together the parties to solve or manage complex issues, things that you cannot sue your way out of. They're systems issues. They're so complicated that you could never explain it to a judge well enough for the judge to make a decision that would make one side a winner or a loser, and certainly not everybody happy. And so I work on a lot of agricultural issues. I'm on the ag team for the Keystone Policy Center. And about 12 years ago, 2014, we launched the Honeybee Health Coalition. So there's a lot of great work being done in pollinator health and conservation, but there was no organization that was working at the intersection of agriculture and bee health. So you never had the crop associations talking with the beekeeping associations, the federal government, all of the NGOs that are working on these issues. Agribusiness and like the supply chain of food companies. And so that's what we did. We launched the Honeybee Health Coalition and brought together all of these stakeholders who coincidentally, really didn't trust each other. At times our meetings were, unfortunately openly hostile, highly emotional. And we've been working at it for 12 years now.
And that's what a mediator does, right?
That's what a mediator does. Yep.
Well, Matt, can we go backwards a little bit? Something
Sure.
you said captured my attention. Something so complex that you couldn't even describe it to a judge. What is it about the honeybee situation? And of course, having watched it for years, it always seems to be in a state of crisis. What is it about that state of the honeybee business that is so complex?
I think that all of the ways or reasons or stressors that are causing the bees to die or to for bee health to be in decline, they're all interrelated and interconnected. And so, like, the quick and dirty elevator pitch is, you know, we have forage and nutrition, we have pesticides and hive management. And so there are 2.5 million hives about in this country. And the beekeepers, you know, 80% of those bees are with commercial beekeepers who drive around in with 18-wheelers full of bees with a forklift on the back. And they go from crop to crop to crop to crop for about 6 months a year. So they start in almonds, and then they work their way up to Oregon. You know, there's all of our, you know, fruits and nuts, and nuts and vegetables. So that 1 in 3 bites of food we eat, you know, when those crops are flowering, it requires a beekeeper to pull up. And so apples and pears and cucumbers and watermelons, you know, hot peppers, you know, all of these different crops that need this commercial beekeeper to pull up. And when those bees aren't in pollination, they're living on ag lands. These beekeepers don't own vast, vast tracts of land. They talk to many farmers, and they say, hey, I'll give you a case of honey if I can keep my bees over here. And the landscape in which they are living in is increasingly has less flowers. So we are removing prairie for agricultural uses and also just for population growth and for cities that are growing. And so these bees that were placed out in these ag lands are having less and less flowers to forage on. And so there is the first part. It's for poor forage and nutrition. And then when those bees are out there, there is incidental pesticide exposure. You know, bees fly 3 miles from their hive. And so you think about what's the 3 mile radius, and they're going to come into contact with pesticides. And pesticides, they're designed to, you know, control weeds, to kill insects. So herbicides, insects, and fungicides. Fungicides kill fungus. And so these bees, they get weakened. So they don't have a good forage. When they do forage, they get, you know, they find pesticides. And those are two weakening factors. And then you have this varroa mite, which is like a tick. It'd be about the size of a dinner plate on a human's body. So very big parasite for a honeybee. And those transmit disease. And so that's why this is a whole systems issue. And it takes all stakeholders working together to solve it. And that's kind of the point of the Honeybee Health Coalition, is these various sectors were all kind of working independently. And they weren't, you know, they were kind of pointing fingers at each other. It's pesticides. No, it's lack of forage. No, it's this mite. But it's all of it. And so that's kind of the secret sauce of the Honeybee Health Coalition, is that we said collectively, yes, it is all of it. Let's work on all of it together instead of pointing fingers and working at odds together. It's going to take all of us working together to solve this.
Where did the idea come from for a concentrated strategy like that? Somebody must have been sitting under an apple tree and had one fall in his head or something. What happened?
You know, it came from really a guy named Jerry Hayes, who was an apiary inspector in Florida. And then the Monsanto, the agrochemical company, the seed company, they acquired a company that had this varroa mite treatment out of Israel. And it was very promising. It's RNAi. So it's double-stranded RNAi that disrupts the Varroa mite's ability to reproduce. And so they brought in Jerry, and it was really, Jerry's now the editor of Bee Culture magazine. And so if you, the ultimate genesis of this came from them saying to my organization, Keystone Policy Center, "Hey, we think that there's an idea to bring stakeholders together. What do you think?" And so we took a small amount of seed money and we did what we call an assessment. So anytime we enter a new issue, we interview like 40, 50 people, and we write a report and say like, is there a lane where dialogue could help that people aren't talking about? And bringing together the National Corn Growers Association and the United Soybean Board, the Almond Board of California, various fruits and vegetable associations with agribusiness, the USDA, the EPA. There's a research organization called Project APIS M that does amazing work. And the beekeeping organizations, you have the American Honey Producers Association, the American Beekeeping Federation. They'd never really been in the same room together, and so those initial meetings is like why I'm involved as a mediator, because getting people to, row in the same direction, even if they're not in the same boat, is helpful. And it's even more helpful for if they're in the same boat.
It seems like they were all heading in the same direction, though. I mean, they all had the same basic desire to pull this situation together.
It's true.
So what
But
would
like,
they have that would have them yelling at each other across the table?
well, they just there's a lack of understanding. And so a lot of bees, because of the nature of our agricultural system, are placed in and around row crops. Corn, canola, soybeans. Corn doesn't need bees. It's a non-pollinated crop. And so they didn't have they would exchange a case of honey. They would say, "Hey, yeah, you can put your bees here and exchange a case of honey." But but then those bees were being put into harm's way from incidental pesticide exposure. And so they didn't really understand each other's systems. And so that was one of the first things we did, was like, let's walk a mile in each other's shoes. We had beekeepers walking through cornfields. We had corn and soybean growers in bee suits and opening up hives and holding them up, and they were telling each other about like, here's what it takes to make this business happen. And so we all have, I always say, and this is just my own personal opinion, that all of these issues are driven by our demands on the environment. So we love driving our cars. We have an ethanol standard. We love eating meat. So we have corn and soy for not all of us, but and so yeah, so it's a it there was a need to get everyone kind of understanding and working in the same direction.
Well, it sounds like a lot of fun, and I'm sure you had a lot of fun going from one group to the next. Oh, come on, let's work together. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Food Chain, Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Today we're talking about bringing the bee people together, and there's a lot of them to bring together, with Matt Malika, who is the Senior Project Director for the Keystone Policy Institute,
It's
or
center, yeah, Keystone Policy Center.
Center. Okay, good. And that's right up above Denver, up there in the mountains, so it's a good place to be. So please do stay tuned, because when we come back, we're going to go after how to pull everything together, and there's so many things to work with. Stay tuned. Well, the question on the table today is, can we come up with a strategy to save the bees and the beekeepers? They've had a couple of really terrible years, and so we need to do something to help this industry survive, for the very basic reason that bees provide 1 in 3 bites of food that we eat. So we may as well pull ourselves together as eaters of food, because we have an interest in this industry as well, whether we want to think we do or not. It's there. Well, Matt, let's start with, is it really as bad as we hear? The last 2 years have been extraordinarily bad. What's going on?
So last year when, so bees kind of hibernate in the winter, especially up higher north. So it's, when it gets cold, they cluster up. And so when the beekeepers wake them up in, January, early February to go to almonds, to pollinate the almond crop, last year they found a lot of their colonies were dead, or they were dwindling. Dwindling means they were on their way out. And so Project APSM and a couple of those did a survey, and they said, okay, beekeepers, like, tell us what you're seeing. And they found that 62% of all of the beehives were dead.
62? So, I heard 56, so that's 62.
Yeah, so that's the Auburn survey, the U.S. beekeeping survey. They had slightly lower numbers, but you talk to commercial beekeepers that really manage the vast majority of hives, and they lost a tremendous amount. And so then the USDA sent in scientists to sample all of these colonies for pesticides, for diseases, and they did find that a lot of these diseases that the varroa mite were vectoring were becoming more virulent. They were becoming stronger. And the number one management solution that beekeepers had was Ametraz. And Ametraz it's a strip you put in your hives that kills the mites but doesn't kill the bees. And the mites were becoming resistant to this treatment.
Which is what always happens, right?
What always happens. Yep. So as something becomes less effective, if you increase the dosage and frequency of how often you use it, all of the mites that you didn't kill then have a gene mutation that treatment doesn't work as well on them. Now, I'll say that not all of the mites had this genetic trait. So there is still just some unknowns here. And then the pesticide issue is certainly another compounding factor. So yeah, they lost a lot of hives, and it depend. We don't know. We're right about the period now in late January where we are going to be finding out, as they're cracking open these hives, whether it's happening again or whether they're getting reprieve.
Not too long before the big almond blossom in California.
Yeah.
And all of those bees must be on duty when that happens, because the almond blossoms don't last very long. So the bees have to be there at that time. Mm-hmm. So this is a significant issue then for the almond industry.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. It's a big input of theirs. In order for them to get crop insurance, they have to place 2 hives per acre in across those acres. And so, they're very keen on making sure this doesn't happen again and supporting the beekeeping industry.
Okay, so it is bad as we think it was for the last 2 years. Our beekeepers have taken a really big hit in the last 2 years. And how will your strategy, how exactly will it work to solve this problem?
Sure. So let's back up a little bit. Okay. So the Honeybee Health Coalition was approached, 18 months ago by the American Honey Producers Association, the American Beekeeping Federation, the Canadian Honey Council, and the Canadian Beekeeping Federation. So we say North America, there's not too much of an organized system down in Mexico, but these are the four big ones, right? And they said, we need a collective strategy. So
these are independent NGOs that work on behalf of different segments of the bee industry?
They're like big associations.
Okay.
So they represent collectively beekeepers.
Okay.
On a national level. And so we started off with a blank sheet of paper. Okay. What would you, first thing you do is you want to outline. Okay. What is it that you want to say? in this strategy. And they came up with three buckets. And it was, pests and disease, the honey market, and research. And, they talk about the varroa mite and what's needed there, getting new tools and treatments into the hands of beekeepers at a cost-effective price. They talk about tropolelaps. Have you heard of tropolelaps, Michael?
Yeah, that's the mite that's in China and Southeast Asia, I believe.
Yep. And so this is, if and when this mite hits our borders, it's going to be devastating. And so they talk about a tropolelaps preparation response. What do we need the U.S. and Canadian governments to be doing? And what do beekeepers need to do to prepare? How do we keep this thing out? And then what to do if it gets here? Back in the 80s, when the varroa mite came in through Florida, there was this eradication effort where they were burning hives. And then beekeepers were afraid to report that they had this mite because they didn't want to get all of their hives destroyed. And there was quarantining, right? But ultimately, when you have this pest on a flying insect, it's like an out-of-control wildfire where you have nothing to put it out.
The only thing you can do is keep it out. Which yep. means significant border investments by everybody. So we have to watch that. Now, there's another element to that, which is probably another bucket, and that's in unfair competition from different kinds of producers in other countries, right?
Yeah, for honey.
For honey.
Yeah, so the U.S. can supply about 60% of our demand for honey. Right, so we don't have enough hives to satisfy all of America's demands and Canadian demands. So it's the honey you find in your grocery store, but it's also all the honey that's in your cereals and your various bars and things that we eat. Like the honey is a huge input into a lot of the food we eat, not just honey that we put on top of our yogurt, but like the honey that's in our food.
Honey Nut Cheerios.
Yes, great example. They found that if they take in other countries honey and they mix into it high fructose corn syrup, for example, or something else, then they can like double the amount of honey, the pound that they're bringing in and getting paid for it by calling it honey, but it's really not honey. It's a honey product. Or something like that. And so, then
ultra processed honey.
Exactly. Right. And they can undercut the cost that it would take for beekeepers to produce that honey, because all they're doing is blending it with some material, and then they're selling it for way cheaper than it could ever be produced at an economically viable level in the US, because, beekeepers are actually doing it the right way. And so that's called adulteration of honey, and it's a really big problem that the North American bee strategy tries to address.
Well, I have done studies through or shows through the years that feature the effort to try to stop Chinese honey from getting into the country, and the difficulties of doing that because if they catch the honey at the border, they send it back, yeah. They send it to a different country, mark a different label on it, and send it in again. So it's a never-ending cops and robbers game to keep this fraudulent or at least mislabeled honey out of the country.
Yeah, I mean, they're always one step ahead, right? So if you create a new test that is looking for certain types of biomarkers, whether that be a type of pollen, right? Well, maybe they just take some of that pollen and sprinkle it in there, and then it's in there. Right. So the honey, the fraudulent honey producers seem to be always one step ahead. And you're right. If it comes in here and it's tested and rejected, it's sent back. It's not destroyed. And so
it's almost like we're telling them, here, try again.
Yeah. And then route it through a different country, maybe add some more honey to it, try to pass our tests. And then send it back here, send it to some other country where they don't have such stringent rules.
So all kinds of things to fight against, whether natural or cultural or economic, is just a war.
Yeah, it really is. And it's hard on the beekeepers who have such slim margins. We're talking, you know, 5-7 cents a pound is their threshold between being in the red and being in the black. And then you're having a fraudulent honey that's coming in, I don't know, 50 cents cheaper. Like it's
significantly cheaper, real cheap stuff.
Yep, it's unfair.
Tell us about your efforts to bring everybody together.
Yeah, so
because you're the mediator, you're the one who calls the meeting to order and asks one side of the table what they think and the other side of the table what they think, right?
Yeah, and we haven't done that with in the honey markets because you know it's kind of a black market of you know Chinese honey that gets shipped through Vietnam and repackaged. Yeah. But in general, started by developing BMPs or best practices for, you know, corn, soy, apples, canola growers. So like, how do you have a productive crop and also protect bees? We talk about habitat creation, planting flowers across the you know, ag landscape.
And of course, that's one thing in California that a lot of growers in the salad bowl of the world are very frightened of doing because they don't want to attract other critters into their production grounds. They want everything to be so sterile that to reduce the chance of E. coli getting in, for example.
Yeah, yeah, and it's hopefully getting better. And also, if you have a crop and you're hiring a beekeeper to pollinate that crop, there was a thought that if you planted flowers on the side, that the bees would go to the flowers and they wouldn't go to the crop. But really, it's just like all of us. Like we need, when you go to the salad bar, you know, you want to get something from every little section and build your salad. And then bees are the same way. So the Honeybee Health Coalition also brought together the pesticide applicators, and they have to get certified every 3 years to be able to put down to do their jobs. To apply pesticides, and they can take our, you know, a lot of industries have continuing education units that they have to take an hour course every to maintain their license. And so one of those courses they can take is on protecting bees in productive agriculture. We do a lot of work in hive management. So we have the Tools for Varroa Management Guide. So teaching beekeepers how to control Varroa. We have a bunch of videos. All of this is free. It's on our website, honeybeehealthcoalition.org. We have information for beekeepers and growers on the things that they need to have in place. You know, a handshake and a case of honey is one thing, but it's sometimes better to have a written contract. And so putting in some of those systems.
It would be hard to get a lot of people to sign a written contract.
Yeah.
No, just my thought. What do you think?
Well, we have just like fact sheets. Like, hey, here's a conversation you could have. Even if there's not a sign on a dotted line, you know, like, are there clean water sources? You know, understanding which way the prevailing winds are going. So you want to put your hives upwind of, so if they put down something to protect crops, that all of that doesn't drift onto the hives.
Right.
You know, don't spray in the middle of the day when.
So let's develop an understanding of how we can best do this. And that's a conversation that has to happen between the beekeeper and whoever the landowner is.
Yep, that's exactly right. We run research projects. So I run the varroacide resistance and testing team. And this is a group trying to find the next varroacide. So we know that mites are becoming resistant to amitraz. And so what's next? You know, so universities and USDA and all of these organizations that are finding, you know, there's a lot of different mites out there. There's tons of mites in the agricultural landscape. What if a miticide for some other crop could actually work on the varroa mite? So we're testing all of those things. Are they effective against the varroa mite? And then working to get those to market. So
I understand some beekeepers are trying selective breeding just to see if they can find the queen that has the resistance. And
yeah.
I guess you have to try everything when it comes right down to with so much going on. Well, we're up for a quick break here in a very short period of time. Matt, but I would like to really get into the North American bee strategy, and the principal focus of it is a standard of identity. Mm-hmm. So it sounds to me like you're trying to establish a position similar to that of like organic farming. This is organic honey, or this would be the North American bee strategy honey. So that will pick up that conversation when we come back. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Matt Malika, who is the Senior Project Director. Did I get that right, Malika?
It's Malika.
Malika.
Yep.
Matt Malika.
Good Polish name.
I like Malika. This is the Food Chain with Michael Olson and Matt Malika. We will be right back. Do stay tuned. Can we save the bee? Can we save the beekeeper? Can we save 1 in 3 bites of food that we eat? So much is involved, it's hard to comprehend that such a little critter could make such a big impact on our lives. But in fact, they do. Do you ever think about that, Matt?
I do, every day.
It's just, wow. And so, standard of identity, the strategy that you and your coalition of like-minded businesses and non-governmental organizations have come up with is we have to find a way to save the bee. And you focus on an identity, a standard of identity. What do you mean by that?
So, all honey is going to have, you know, markers that show whether it was produced by a bee or whether it was produced in a lab. And so, and as we talked about before, the
produced in a lab
or produced in a factory.
Okay. Gotcha.
You know, not through the use of honeybees. And so, you know, there's a couple different aspects of the North American bee strategy. It identifies all of the ways that honey production and processing violates the standards. What's the practice and what has been violated? And then it recommends a standard of identity that shows the unique character of honey. So these North American beekeepers that came together really support federal oversight on the issue of honey testing to encourage a level playing field. And to do that through a standard of identity for commercially significant kinds of honey that allows for enforcement. These fraudulent, adulterated honey should be identified in the marketplace. People need to know, are they eating real honey, or is it more of a honey product? It has to be identified by region, by floral resources. And it really needs to elevate honey from a commodity where price alone dictates its value to a product that's celebrated for its variety and regional uniqueness, very much like wine. They support the U.S. Pharmacopoeia standard in a fingerprinting technique to work. But there's a lot more details to work out.
Sure. I once had the opportunity to speak to some family-sized dairy farmers in Quebec. They had small farms that were supported by the government. But it came to pass that they were losing their support from the government and that they were going to have to compete against those large dairy operations in the United States, which operate on economies of scale. And so they invited me to address them with, how are we going to deal with this? I guess I was kind of in the same place that you are. But I suggested to them, first and foremost, you can't compete with somebody who has that kind of economies of scale and are working on that industrial scale production, because you're just family scale farmers. But you have something that they don't have, which is grass-fed cows producing milk rich in the vitamins and minerals that they don't have with the industrial-sized farms. So you have to somehow bring yourself together and work together to establish a way of doing things that you can all get along with, and that gives your brand of substance.
Yep, and differentiation.
Yes, you have to differentiate yourself from that industrial grade stuff. That's what you are doing, is you're in differentiating yourselves or ourselves here in North America from the worldwide honey food chain.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. So if you go to a lot of people like local honey because it has positive health effects, especially for if people have allergies, for example.
Yeah.
And so, you know, your local farmer's market is going to have honey that you can buy that helps with allergies. And then, you know, your honey in your grocery stores, you know, a lot of those are differentiated. But when you see like grade A honey, it doesn't really mean anything. There's not a standard of identity behind it like USDA organic.
So is grade A honey a federal designation?
I don't believe so. Okay. I think it's something that people just put on their labels.
Oh, okay. So it's something I can say. And it's what people used to do with the word organic before organic became a legal word.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. And then you also have, you know, all of these inputs to our foods and our cereals. And, you know, if you're a huge company producing cereal, you want consistency, right? You want that honey to taste the exact same every time you get a shipment of it in. And so that your Honey Nut Cheerios from 1987 that you remember as a kid taste the exact same as they do in 2026 now that you're an adult. And so, you know, you don't really want a lot of, you know,
uniqueness,
right? You kind of want that to, you want your honey to be the same over time. And so there's kind of these two different markets that are taking place.
Well, there's the food manufacturing market, and then there's a consumer market.
Yeah.
And so one can handle industrial production of honeys, I guess, pretty substantially. When you're making Honey Nut Cheerios, you're making a lot of it, so you can handle, and you need that consistency. So you're talking an industrial kind of situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. And they're also looking for, their margins are thin too, I imagine.
Sure.
And so they just put honey in the ingredients list. They don't put, you know, local U.S. made honey or you know, something of the like. They just list it as honey. So they're, you know, they're not trying to differentiate themselves in the market by having, you know, very specific honey that has any claim to helping with allergies, for example.
Now your honey that will have a name. Do you have a name for it?
No, it's very much, and it's not, as I'm not a beekeeper, what they're asking for is, you know, these standards of identity and the creation of a thorough database of samples of honey from each testing method overseen by an independent body. That's what these beekeeping organizations are asking for, to combat honey fraud and ensure a high quality supply of honey.
Mm-hmm. So a certification agency.
Yeah, something that where it levels the playing field.
Mm-hmm.
So that they test all of the honey coming in and reject it, but it doesn't pass the test. They have these fancy tests. One of them is called the nuclear magnetic resonance. And so, but once again, the honey adulterers are always kind of one step ahead.
You will need some kind of name or some kind of designation such as certified organic or certified real honey or something, in order to present to the public, whether it's they're manufacturing Honey Nut Cheerios or just local consumers.
Yeah, a lot of it comes down to blending. And so it's not that it's not honey. It's that it's maybe only 30% honey, you know, and that they're increasing the poundage that they're sending. A lot of what the North American bee strategy, or one aspect of it, is holding those people accountable for people that are trying to sell this fraudulent honey and avoid paying the appropriate tariffs or duties on imported honey, and then fooling the public into thinking that it's actually honey. They just want transparency.
And with that transparency, you need a name, because that's how people will recognize you. People need something, a name. So we'll look forward to that when it comes together. When it came time to bringing the groups together to affect the strategy, what was your selling point?
Well, they came to us to do it. And so I run the Honeybee Health Coalition, which is talking about bee health. The honey market is a little bit of a side. That's beekeeper health and the success of an industry. And so I always say this is their strategy. Okay, this is American Beekeeping Federation, American Honey Producers, Canadian Honey Council, and Canadian Beekeeping Federation. This is their strategy. Honeybee Health Coalition did this as a service, we bring groups together. And so really it was all on them to say, what do you want to put in this? And we helped facilitate that process.
Okay, so then they will have all kinds of things to be working with to keep their coalition of farmers together so that everybody's heading in the same direction.
Yeah.
Out here in the coast, we have a berry company called Driscoll's, and they have lots of farmers, but they're all doing the same thing, pretty much. Mm-hmm. The same varieties of berries and using the same cultural practices and whatnot. And that way, when they sell a Driscoll berry, people pretty much know it's going to be same as the last berry that they had. Mm-hmm. And so somehow, the beekeepers themselves will have to figure out how to work together to affect this.
Well, and a lot of this will come down to, you know, policy solutions on a federal level. And so having all of these groups have a statement or a strategy. So when they're walking into senators' offices or you know, members of the House, that they have that they are walking in lockstep. And that really doesn't happen now. And one of the things that we're trying to do is get them on the same policy agenda. And so increasing their political power by unifying. They don't have to be one organization. They're always going to be, you know, these different organizations that have different, you know, audiences, niches, but they are a sector, and so their interest is bee health and the health of the beekeeping industry. And so this is kind of a first step in having them all row in the same direction.
Are these the people that yell across the table at each other?
No, those are mostly, the differences of opinion between, like, row crop agriculture, pesticide companies, and beekeeping organizations. And
that's a hard one to bring together, because they're essentially not together at all. When you're spreading pesticides and you're trying to raise bees, those are two different things, right?
Yeah, but we're all one agricultural system. And so if you're a row crop farmer, you probably have a neighbor down the street that grows watermelons, and we're all trying to provide food for a growing population, whether that's fruits, vegetables, and nuts, or honey. And so it all comes down to, you know, the demand that 330 million people put on our landscape.
And it's always about a contention between people and the environment when it gets right down to poor agriculture, which once had the vote, but now the vote is in the city.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought.
And so it's always going to be this contention between the city and the farm.
And I would also say that the agriculture lobby has a very strong voice in Washington, D.C. Farmers still make up a major constituency and are well organized. And I think that the beekeeping industry is on the path to becoming more organized.
Thanks to you and your people who are working with you for pulling this together. I think it really is a genuine service to the entire ag community and to those of us out here who happen to eat food.
Yeah, I agree. And that's, you know, I work for a small nonprofit that works on difficult issues, right? So the Keystone Policy Center, I'm on the ag team, but we also have work in natural resources and energy, public health, and education. So there's many other aspects that my organization touches beyond just bees. We're all trying to create a wheel that's moving in the same direction.
Yeah. Even those of us who use pesticides and whatnot to grow our crops, we still need the bee as well. So
yeah,
we're all heading in the same direction here.
Yeah. Well, and if you had the reason that farmers use pesticides is not because they want to, like, you know, poison the earth, or like there are real pests that attack those crops that they have millions of dollars invested in. Yeah. And if they don't use them, then they lose their crop.
Yeah.
You know, and so like it, that's where that building understanding is so important, because there really is that the pesticides are expensive.
Yep.
They are not doing this because they want to. You know, they're doing it because without it, they wouldn't have a crop some years. So there's negative effects on bees, but like understanding the realities of farming, you're not going to tear the system down and start over, because then we're not going to have food. You know, and so you have to start where we are and evolve to where we want to be. Beekeepers are incredibly resilient in making sure that there's enough bees. They can split their hives. So if they, you know, they can requeen them, they can kill the varroamites, they can do all of these things. But, you know, from the general public, plant flowers.
Plant flowers and eat honey.
And eat honey. You know, we're all trying to work together. And so, like, there's just certain realities of how we do it that's most important. So that's kind of my role, is like I think of myself as like the center of the axle on a car or on a bicycle, and all of the stakeholders are the spokes going out, and we're all trying to create a wheel that's moving in the same direction.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get at. We're all going in the same direction. Even those of us who use pesticides and whatnot to grow our crops still need the bee as well.
Yeah.
We're all heading in the same direction here. Matt Malika, are we going to have bees this year?
I hope so. There certainly will be bees.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.